As many of you know, last year, just a little over a year ago, we got a dog. Brought home a puppy named Samwise. Samwise, named after Frodo's faithful companion in The Lord of the Rings, felt very appropriate. Samwise came to our house at probably, 6 or 7 pounds. He's, I'm pretty sure, safely over 100 now. But he's still a baby. He's a big dog who's very friendly and has a very sensitive emotional constitution. We are so good to this dog. He has just a gaggle of children fawning over him all day. He gets fed well. He has a big backyard to run around and play in. In fact, when he came to our house, my wife is so tender-hearted that we put this little puppy in the crate, and she slept on an air mattress next to his crate for the first week just to make sure he didn't feel alone. This is a dog that is well cared for. And yet, there's one thing that we have to do on a regular basis with our dog that is good for him, that makes him question the goodness of the family that took him home. And that is trimming his nails. This dog is the friendliest, most easygoing dog. And yet, he is so sensitive to even the sight of the clippers that we have to sneak up behind him when he's real tired, with the clippers behind our back, because otherwise he will freak out. And just while he's real lethargic, usually late at night, we just bend down and clip one. We're lucky to get one. Because for some reason, this dog, who has been so pampered and cared for, when those nail clippers come out, immediately thinks, these people are trying to kill me. Why would he think that? I have no idea. There's just something about those nail clippers. There's something unpleasant. It's not painful, but something uncomfortable about getting his nails clipped. I think it's he doesn't like people grabbing his back paws where he can't really see what's going on. That he, in that moment, as a dog, is not thinking, you know what? I should give these people the benefit of the doubt because they have selflessly cared for me daily, continuously, since I was 9 weeks old. But he doesn't think that. He just thinks, I don't like this. And it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound so funny? So nonsensical. Isn't it good that human beings aren't that way? And yet we totally are. It is amazing how one day we can be resting, rejoicing in God's goodness. We might be sitting out on our back porch after a pleasant day at work, and the kids were good, and there's a little money in the bank, and our health is good, and we say, oh God, thank you so much for faithfulness, your abundant provision, your grace in my life. And then we go into work next day, and things are tight, so we get a big pay cut. And we think, God, where are you? Have you abandoned me? How fickle we are. When trouble hits our life, do we rest in the goodness of God that has been so thoroughly and continually and firmly established? Or do we freak out, thinking, because this is an uncomfortable situation for me, it must mean that God doesn't love me, or he doesn't exist, or he's not good. He doesn't have my good in mind. Because how could he have my good in mind if he let me go through this situation? when we don't understand why we're facing whatever situation we are, does it galvanize our trust in the Lord? Or does it weaken it? Does it reveal it to be shaky, to be fickle, to be situational? As Christian people, we often, and I'm throwing myself in here at the head of the pack, we often fail to address difficult situations in our life that reflects, in a way that reflects the fact that things are different for us. That there is a truth regarding salvation, regarding our adoption as God's people, regarding our eternal, unshakable hope that ought to undergird and inform the way that we address difficulties in our life that often fails to, because we panic. Because we too often are not willing to look beyond the difficulty that is in our immediate view. And so we end up in sort of an emotional free fall, as if we had no hope in Christ. Not only is this dishonoring to the Lord who saved us, it is a sinful response to difficulty. It's also unnecessary. Because the Christian's right response to stress, the Christian's right response to trouble, is a steadfast trust in God's goodness. And that trust in God's goodness leads to joy. If you would turn with me to Psalm 31, David's going to give us a testimony about this, about him facing real difficulty in his life, and yet, by resting firmly in God's goodness, when all the other things in his life and all the other people in his life were falling away, led to a kind of joy, a kind of confidence, a rest in the midst of his difficulty that he would not otherwise have been able to experience. And I hope that as we look at this, that as we see in David both reflections of Christ's faithfulness and reflections of David as one of God's people and us as one of God's people, and we see the reasons why David could so firmly trust in God's unwavering goodness, I hope that as we see these reasons, we will evaluate whether we approach difficulty in our lives the same way. And if not, I hope that we're either informed or reminded of precious truth that we as Christian people get to cling to in the midst of difficulty, rather than facing trouble as if we had no hope. As I said, the Christian's right response to stress, to trouble, to anxiety in life, is a steadfast trust in God's goodness, and it leads to joy. And in this psalm, we're going to see three reasons why. Psalm 31 says this: to the choir master, a psalm of David. In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. And for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. You take me out of the net they have hidden for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love, because you have seen my affliction. You have known the distress of my soul, and you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief, my soul and my body also. For my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity and my bones waste away. Because of all my adversaries, I've become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel, for I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you and worked for those who take refuge in you, in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me. When I was in a besieged city, I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight. But you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. That final verse is an admonition that sums up what David is getting at through this psalm. Be strong, take courage, you who wait for the Lord. Because the Lord is good. We're going to see why. Firstly, we can trust God's goodness because of his unfailing character. In the first few verses of this psalm, we see David, one, making a declaration, I take refuge in you, God, and uses several different words repeatedly through those first five verses. He uses the term rock. He uses the term refuge. He uses the term fortress. These are words that indicate something very visible, very tangible, don't they? Like a cave in a storm, or a place to hide when the enemy is closing in. These are words that indicate something that is both strong, impenetrable, but also safe. A place to be safe. It's not just strength for its own sake, but a strong place where the weak can go and be protected. It's a safe haven, but not just a safe haven, one that doesn't fail, one that can't be destroyed. Because as David is going to continue talking about in this passage, not everything is that way. Other things feel safe. Other things feel like a place to retreat until they aren't. We may find our rest, our sense of security and confidence in our job until the job's gone. We may feel safe. We may rest in the confidence of our own bodily health until we're not healthy anymore. These things are safe havens until they're not safe anymore. And we have very little control over how safe they are and whether they stay that way. But as David helps us understand, God is different than that. He is resilient in a way that other things are not resilient. He is sure and steady in a way that other things are not. So David, in these first few verses, characterizes God as refuge, as fortress, as rock. And because of David resting in that way of characterizing God, he asks his prayer in a couple different ways that are interesting. One is, in your righteousness, deliver me. And for your name's sake, he says, you lead and guide me. David can ask and rely on God to lead him and protect him and guide him because of his character. He can say, God, deliver me in your righteousness. That is to say, I know that you are righteous, that you do what you say you'll do, that you will not let injustice dwell forever. I understand that you have revealed yourself to be a just God. So I'm pleading with you in what I already know to be true of your character, that in that righteousness to deliver me, to protect me, to preserve me, to guide me. Because he can rest on the fact that God hasn't changed. God is righteous, so he saves those he's redeemed. God desires to show his glory. That is to say, when he says, for your name's sake, lead and guide me, he's appealing to God's intrinsic desire to glorify himself. And so he says, I can trust you. I can trust you because for you to lead and guide your people is glorifying to you. So I pray, God, you would glorify yourself by doing this for me. David can trust the fact that the way that God has in times past revealed himself to be is still how he is. That's why he can say in verse 5, into your hands I commit my spirit. Jesus quotes this psalm as his last words before he dies on the cross. We read that in Luke 23. That David, in the midst of his difficulty, feeling abandoned by everybody and everything else, foreshadowing the total abandonment that Christ would experience on the cross. And yet, even in the midst of that despair, even in the midst of that incredible, unspeakable, excruciating and trouble and pain, that David and then Christ could say, God, into your hands I commit my spirit. That is to say, the deepest, most vulnerable, realist part of who I am placing entirely in your hands because you are so trustworthy. Despite what's happening around me, I can say, God, my soul is in your hands. I commit my soul to you because there's no other safe place for it. Rather than allowing the difficulty of his circumstances to lead him to question God's character, David says, wow, these crumbling circumstances around me just show what a contrast you are to these things, God. You are the sure fortress, the rock, the refuge where I can place my spirit and know that it's safe. In verse 6, he begins to talk about the attitude that this leads him to. He says, I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. Trusting in idols is stupid, he says. It's worthless. That's why I don't do it. I trust in the Lord. Idols can't save. Idols can't be relied on. I've said this before, but idolatry is one of those things that we often relegate to the past. That this is the issue of idolatry was something that these primitive pagan nations wrestled with, but that's not really a thing anymore. The vast majority of people, if you go into their house, they don't have a little stone or wood or iron animal trinket or something sitting on their mantle that they pray to. And yet, idolatry is one of the systemic problems that we see in the Old Testament that is most profoundly tied to how we live today. In fact, it's at the heart of the human condition. Our sinfulness is an idolatry, a tendency to worship anything and everything except God himself. And so when David says, idols are worthless, it is stupid to rely on idols, I trust in the Lord, is a word for us today just as much as it was back then. Because we are so eager, even as Christian people, too often to rely on so many other things rather than God when trouble strikes. And yet David says, that's dumb. God has shown that he's not like anything else or anyone else. He is the one who can be relied on so profoundly, so distinctly, so comprehensively more than anything else, because he is so different, because he is unchanging. His character is consistent. Verse 17, he said, Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Those who are proud, who hate you, who do not worship you. He says, God, I'm calling to you because I want you to show your work in my life. I want you to display your glory, your faithfulness, your worthiness, your grace through my life. Confound the attempts of the wicked people who would be happy to show that you don't come through, that you're unfaithful. I want you to confound them. I want you to do a work in my life that you would display to the people around me why I would trust you in the midst of this difficulty. And those who would say that that's stupid, make them feel stupid. When trouble strikes, what do we run to? Do we run to those things that just can't hold the weight of our anxiety? It might be keeping busy with a hobby or numbing our minds with Netflix binges. It might be bartering with ourselves. Sometimes we think, when maybe our job is on the line, we think, well, I'm not sure if my job's going to work out, but it probably will, and we've got enough money in the bank, and we can do this and that. And we're not really any more confident or assured in the midst of the situation. We're trying to repaint our situation in such a way that it doesn't seem so bad, rather than saying, God, I freely acknowledge there are circumstances here I have no control over, but I trust in you. Whether I keep my job or lose it, whether the test from the doctor comes back positive or negative, I have no control over these things, but you do. And you've shown your faithfulness, your goodness to me so consistently that the circumstances going the way I prefer or the way I don't, do not diminish your goodness to me. We can trust God because he's so dependable, so faithful. We can trust God's goodness because of his unfailing character. We can also trust God's goodness because of his strengthening grace. In verse 9, in the first part of verse 10, David says, be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief, my soul and my body also, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. David comes to the Lord in the freedom to say, I have nothing. I bring nothing. This is not me needing a boost. I'm not coming to you as some means of self-help. This is not me saying, I've got mostly my life together, but I could really use a life coach right now. This is David saying, I am broken, I am spent, I bring nothing of value to you, God. Anything and everything of value that needs to flood and fill my life to persevere in the midst of this difficult situation, it has to come from you. In verse 10, the second part, he says, my strength fails because of my iniquity. David acknowledges that at least a part of his situation, we're not sure historically what situation he's writing about here, but at least part of the trouble that he's facing has arisen because of his own sinfulness. He freely acknowledges it. He says, God, I am broken and distraught. But there's not self-pity here. He says, God, my sin has really messed up my situation. But it's important for us to recognize this because we may have this misunderstanding in our minds that if we're dealing with a difficult situation that is morally neutral or has been thrust upon us totally externally, we can go to the Lord for help. But if we're in a difficult situation that's arisen at least in part because of our own sin, we're on our own. We made our bed, we can sleep in it, so to speak. And that's not what David's doing here. He says, God, you know, at least to a certain extent, some of my trouble has arisen because of my own sin, and yet I know that I can rest on your grace. That is to say, your unmerited favor that strengthens your people, despite the fact that my sin has made my situation worse. His relationship with the Lord, his relationship with Yahweh, his covenant God, did not depend on his own sinlessness. It is funny how too often we go to the Lord with either confidence or a lack thereof based on how we feel like we've been doing lately in our Christian life. Like if we feel like we've been nailing it with our devotional time, our church attendance has been good, then we can come to the Lord in confidence. But if our Bible reading's been spotty, we weren't really paying attention to the sermon last week at church, we think, oh boy, I don't know, can I still go to the Lord? Maybe we do, and we're kind of sheepish. This is not me excusing away the need for self-examination, because that's important. But oftentimes, we betray a works-based righteousness mentality when our confidence before the Lord in our prayer life is dependent upon how performant we think we've been. David says, God, I need your grace. Regardless of the situation, I acknowledge my sin. I understand. I'm not brushing it aside. I'm not minimizing it. But I understand that me having sin in my life does not recuse me from the ability to ask for God's grace in my life. And so in verse 19, he says, oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you've stored up for those who fear you and worked for those who take refuge in you in the sight of the children of mankind. That is to say, you display your grace, your goodness in the lives of your people before everybody. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. This goodness that he talks about, how abundant is your goodness? The way this would be talked about in the New Testament, the word that they would use is grace. That is to say, as we saw in Romans last year, God's grace is strictly defined God's unmerited favor. God giving us something that we don't deserve, and that, yet we know that the Bible uses it in a more particular way than that, which is to say God's unmerited empowerment that he gives to his people to sustain them and preserve them. And that's what David's celebrating here. God, your goodness, your grace is abundant. You have storehouses of it for those who fear you. That is to say, those who reverently recognize that God is who he says he is and will do what he says he will do. Which is to say, Christians. In verse 23, he gives us admonition because of this. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. David, even in the midst of this encouraging exhortation, reveals the need for God's grace. Which is to say that God's goodness is generally not manifested in the fact that he takes hard situations away from us, but that he strengthens and preserves us in and through those situations. Often our instinct when trouble comes is to say, God, take it away. And that's natural, right? That's not intrinsically wrong either. If we go to the doctor for a physical and he says, you know, you've got something that concerns me. I want you to get this lab test done next week. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with saying, God, you know, my heart is that that test would come back negative. And yet, at the same time, it is the Christian attitude to say, but if not, God, I pray you would sustain me by your grace to live in obedience and faithfulness in a way that would glorify you in the midst of whatever situation in your sovereign goodness you have decided to give me. If I go back to the doctor and he says, good news, it was a false alarm, no big deal, that you would be glorified in that. And if I go back to the doctor and he says, you have 30 days to live, that you would be glorified in that. James 1, right at the beginning of James's letter, as soon as he says, this is from James. Okay, guys, listen up. Verse 2, he says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you face trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. In other words, James says, when bad stuff, hard stuff, painful stuff hits you, rejoice, because you know this is God's means of growing you. And without pain, without trouble, without tragedy, you won't grow. Having hard stuff come along is not a sign that God is not good. If we say, well, when things are good, God is good. When things are bad, God is bad. When trouble comes and God sustains us by his grace in the midst of that pain and difficulty and uncertainty, his goodness shines through that much more distinctly when things are comfortable and easy. Because when things are comfortable and easy, it's also easy for us to take credit for it. When trouble comes, our instinct is to ask God to take it away, and that's okay to a certain extent. But our focus should be on asking God to strengthen us in the midst of that difficulty, rather than easing it. Because we can trust the goodness of God because of his unfailing character. We can also trust his goodness because of his strengthening grace. And finally, we can trust God's goodness because of his merciful love. In verse 7, he says, I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love because you have seen my affliction. You have known the distress of my soul. In the first part of verse 8, he says, and you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. I will rejoice. Why? He has joy. Why? Because God has met him in his pain and sustained him. when we see God's loving care, his unfailing character, when we see his grace poured out in our lives, the manifestations of these things intrinsically reflect that he's a merciful, loving God. And this gives us reason to be joyful. We talked about this last week, maybe the week before, that joy and happiness are not totally distinct. They're not separate concepts. It's really what they're founded on. Happiness is fragile. Happiness is related to the word happen. Like whatever our happenings happen to be can make us happy or not. So that comes and that goes. Joy is very similar, except that it's rooted in something that's not our happenings. That's not our circumstances of the day. But it's something deeper. Something more firmly rooted than happiness. Because it's rooted in something that doesn't change. It doesn't undulate with the circumstances of the day. And so David says, despite my pain, you have met me in this. You've displayed your love, your character, your grace to me, and it gives me a reason to be joyful. You have met me. You have known me in my affliction. You're not far away, but you've shown your nearness, your love for me, and so I can be joyful. In the second part of verse 8, he says, you have set my feet in a broad place. There's no indication in this psalm that David's situation has really changed that much. But David says, I can see a manifestation of your love for me, even in the midst of this situation. And I can see I've got a freedom, I have an inheritance that just transcends my circumstances to where the difficulty of my time right now just dwindles in my vision. And the broadness of what you have given to me, the vastness of what you've promised to me, comes to the forefront. So, in verse 11, being honest about a situation, he says, my adversary, because of all my adversaries, I've become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, an object of dread to my acquaintances. People are whispering about me. I've been forgotten. I've been abandoned. People are plotting against me, gossiping about me. Everyone else has abandoned me. But, in verse 14, but I trust in you, O Lord. I've said, you are my God. These people are not my gods. It's easy for us to try to make a little God out of a person, to try to put the weight of our self-worth and our identity on another broken human being. David says, I'm not going to do that. One, by your grace, I can trust you even when I see clearly that everyone else has failed me. Either they've just walked away or they've actually turned against me. I know I've had situations in my life where I felt that way. He says, so it's a good thing that I'm not relying on them to get me through this situation because I trust in you. You are my God. You've continued to love me, to show your nearness, your faithfulness, even when no one else has. And that's a reason for joy. So in verse 15, David can say, my times are in your hand. That's an encouraging thought. Very much reflects the sentiment of verse 5. Into your hands I commit my spirit. God, in your hands are my times placed. The circumstances that will befall me, they're in your hands. You have total control over these things. David can joyfully trust God to preserve him in trial because he's shown his love so abundantly, so clearly. His love, his faithfulness is so dependable. Others have abandoned him. God has not. So who better to entrust himself to? Who better to rest in? David can say, God, you've shown yourself to be so faithful, to be so gracious, to be so consistent in your love for me. It works out great that you're the one in control of my circumstances. I can be joyful in my circumstances because I know that to be true. In verse 21, he says, "Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city." That's a distinct picture, isn't it? He's under attack, and God showed his love for him. In 22, he says, "I had said it in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight." That's very real. David felt abandoned, but he wasn't. He said, in my panic, as this trouble was befalling me, I said, I am toast. I am hopeless here. But he said, but actually that wasn't true. I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight, but you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help. God showed that by preserving and strengthening him in the midst of his trouble, God was very much present in the midst of that difficulty, and that he truly cared for David. And it's the same for us. When we experience trouble, do we tend to think that God has abandoned us? Does it cause us to doubt his love? Because God is the only one that we can be sure will never fail us, will never waver in his love for us. We can find joy in his merciful love, no matter what our circumstances are. Our circumstances, rather than causing us to question God's character and his faithfulness, ought to show us that much more distinctly how fragile the other things in life are that we depend on. Our right response to stress, to trouble in this life, is a steadfast trust in God's goodness, which leads to joy. We can trust him because of his unfailing character, because of his strengthening grace, because of his merciful love. Let's pray.